from the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, a country divided, days of election delays, and a closer look at America's voters. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and Reagan Republican. On Thursday of this week, it was still not clear who would control the House or the Senate. But one thing was crystal clear. There are a lot of tough battles to come. Joining Tony to talk about the outcome of the election and what else we can learn from it is Congressman Greg Pence of Indiana.
Congressman Pence, welcome to Washington Watch and Semper Fi.
Semper Fi. Thanks for having me, Tony. So did I hear you say happy birthday, fellow Marine?
That is right. Happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday. I've been celebrating the birthday all day. Veterans Drug Court, which was a real honor for me.
Well, let's talk about this. We've had a little bit of time for the elections to sink in. We're still tracking the numbers in terms of where the balance of the House is going to be, but it looks pretty certain it's just a matter of the margins that the Republicans will be in control of the House. But I think one of the messages coming away from this election is undeniable. I mean, now we've had a split 50-50 Senate. You know, we've had a House that's narrowly divided. We are a divided nation.
Well, we are, but I think we can do something about that going forward. One is a little bit how we behave going forward. The way that I have been treated in the minority for the last 4 years is hopefully not the way that we treat the other side. I'm looking forward to us getting about the business of Congress, passing bills, reducing regulations, which I think is how we fight inflation. And I hope that the oversight that we do isn't a repeat of the witch hunts that we've seen the Democrats do since President Trump was elected.
So do you think that there'll be a more open process where we'll actually have debate over legislation and there'll be more votes? Because what we've seen under Nancy Pelosi as Speaker, essentially, as you said, the minority party, the Republicans, have been shut out from the process.
Yeah, Tony, that's one of the major things we're going to do differently. Kevin McCarthy said that when we take back the House and when he's the Speaker, and he will be the Speaker after we are taking the House, that we will go back to what's called regular order. And for the viewers and listeners that aren't familiar with that, we would literally go introduce bills in subcommittees, debate it, mark it up, add amendments, send it up to the committee, debate it, mark it up, and send it onto the floor for debate and final passage. And that's the way we should do it, so that we can have all the experts that we bring in each committee setting. And even from the other side, there are people on the other side that have some expertise in certain areas, and that regular order will be how we will do things the proper way and do the work of the people, instead of what I and even my Democratic peers experienced even more so this year, was just top down. Here's a bill. One night I got a bill, my phone dinged me, and it went off at 3:05 in the morning, and we had a 2,456-page bill that the vote was scheduled for the next day at 10:30. We were able to push it off to 6:30, but Tony, no one read that bill, and even my peers on the other side of the aisle didn't know what was in it.
Well, and Congressman, what you're describing there is also the way you build consensus. When everybody has a part to play, and I go back to my days in the state legislature, and that was the collaborative process. It wasn't always everything you wanted on the other end of it, but everybody had a part to play in it, and quite frankly, a lot of times it turned out better because, as you said, you had different expertise. People with different expertise weighing in on it. But I think more importantly than even a fine-tuned bill is preserving our republic, which is a process by where everybody has a part to play. And when one part feels shut out, silenced, that's a recipe for trouble.
Well, Tony, and you're absolutely right. And in the broader picture of regular order having been thrown out, there's also little things. I'm one of only 12, maybe, congressmen and or women that actually showed up and every proxy voted. And when you talk about building consensus, whether it's in committee or on the floor or meeting with the peers on your side and the other side, you know, you got to show up for work first. And right. I have made every committee meeting in person, unless I took my wife for surgery. But I showed up in person all during COVID and during the pandemic. And the rules that we have right now under Nancy Pelosi, you don't have to show up. You can proxy vote. And that's if you have COVID, dealing with COVID, or have been exposed with COVID. But that got thrown out. You have to sign an affidavit, but people aren't doing that. They're just not showing up for work. And that adds to the divisiveness. You can't get to know people if you're not around people.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Because you tend to treat people with a little more civility when you know them. And that's, I go back to my days in the legislature when Steve Scalise and I were elected at the same time and served in Louisiana, and we were in the deep minority as Republicans, but we worked very well with our Democratic colleagues because we knew each other and we shaped that legislation together. So the process as leadership is going to be elected possibly next week. We don't know as we see we're waiting for all the votes to be counted. But what you're talking about are the rules that govern the way the House operates. Is that going to be at the forefront of the discussion of the election of leadership?
Well, that will be on Monday when we get out there. We're going to have the leadership presentations, those that want to run for leadership office in the Republican conference. And then in the evening and then the next day, those that want to add, change some of the rules, the way that the conference operates, which then would inure to the floor operation as well. You'll be introducing and debating those. And then we'll be voting on those on Tuesday, Wednesday, and some other things on Friday. So really, next week's the organizational week. And you bring up a great point, Tony. You know, who's going to be involved? How many seats will we have? How many members will we have? And this dragging on, I sure hope, you know, I'm in Indiana, in the state of Indiana. We had everything counted by, I think, midnight or certainly Wednesday morning. It's a real shame what's happening in so many other states. I think the last count I had about an hour and a half ago is we didn't have 39 representatives identified yet. You know, it's almost 10%, 8%.
Yeah, I'm out in California, and there's still several seats undecided here. I think last I heard they were taking their shoes off to use their toes to count with. I'm not sure, but maybe that was rumor. Greg, great to see you. Thanks
Good to
so
see
much
you. Thanks for
joining
me.
Us today.
God bless everybody. Semper Fi.
All right. Semper Fi. All right. When we come back, we're going to take a closer look at the current numbers. Where do the Republicans stand in their pursuit of the majority? And we're also going to take a look at the Senate. Where do those outstanding Senate seats stand? And we're going to go a little bit deeper as we look into the results of this past election. So don't go away. Lots more Washington Watch to come. Check out the website, TonyPerkins.com. Resources there for you. And get ready. As I said, the lame duck session of Congress is going to be coming up, and we're going to need you to weigh in. There's going to be some critical, critical votes, many of them attacking religious freedom. So stick with us. We're coming back after this.
Today, finding a trustworthy news source is harder than ever. There are so many news outlets and so much conflicting information, it can be difficult to know who to trust. For this reason, Family Research Council set out to create a solution. The Washington Stand, FRC's online news platform with a mission to provide readers with accurate, free, and relevant news stories and commentaries, all from a biblical worldview. Based in Washington, D.C., The Washington Stand has a team of reporters who provide credible information on the biggest issues of the day. They cover breaking news ranging from what's happening at the Supreme Court to critical public education stories, updates on the state of religious liberty domestically and internationally, and more. The Washington Stand was created to keep you and your family informed on the events that are affecting faith, family, and freedom. So, be encouraged, stay in the know, and stand firm in truth by visiting WashingtonStand.com today. Again, that's WashingtonStand.com. We live in a culture where young men, husbands, and fathers are rarely presented with godly illustrations of manhood. The news, social media, and entertainment often fail to present these examples. That is why Family Research Council created Stand Courageous Men's Ministry. It is led by compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day and will invest in unpacking a man's role as defenders, providers, instructors, chaplains, and battle buddies so that they can embrace their identity as men and fight the battles every man faces. Learn more at standcourageous.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. We're broadcasting from Southern California in the studios of his channel. We're grateful for their hospitality and their partnership with Washington Watch. Well, it's an unfortunate reality. We're getting more accustomed to having to wait for the outcome of every election. Some people say this is crazy. With all of the technology, why is it taking us days after the polls close to find out the results of an election? Well, hold on to that thought, because we're going to talk about that a little bit later when I'm joined by Ken Blackwell. But there are several congressional races that are still yet to be called. Now, as I said, we're going to talk about why later, but let's take a look now at what those races are, what the projections might be, and how long could this last? Joining me now to talk about this and more is Matt Carpenter. He is the director of FRC Action. Matt, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me, Tony. Great to be with you.
Okay, Matt, it's after 5 p.m. now on the East Coast, and most places are still counting, especially out here in the West. What's the latest on control of the House?
So depending on who you listen to, Tony, the Democrats control right now anywhere from about 192 to 204 seats in the House. On the GOP side, again, depending on who you're listening to, it's anywhere in the range of about 209 to about 220. And again, those are just different prognosticators looking at their forecasting modeling. There's about 30 races that have yet to be called. 15 of which are in California. So I don't know, if you get out of the studio, maybe you can find some precincts and help them count some ballots.
So 218 is what's needed to claim the majority. And so if there's projections saying the Republicans could have 210, now that is a narrow majority. What is the range that we're hearing in terms of what the majority might be?
I think the high mark would be about 220. I've seen maybe 226. Again, it seems to be we're looking at not much past that. 230 seems to have gone out the window at this point. There are a lot of races that have yet to be called in Arizona, in places like Washington is still counting ballots, in California, as I previously stated. You have some races where, Tony, they have 26% reporting. So this is going to go on into next week. We can expect this some razor-thin margins as well. I'm also looking at Colorado 3, where Lauren Boebert is running. She was down most of the night on election night, and she's come roaring back, and now she's up by, I think, a few hundred votes there. So we're looking at a photo finish in a lot of these races. It's going to be very close.
Let's talk about the Senate. Where does the Senate stand?
So there are several key races out right now. Currently, Democrats control 48 seats to Republicans 49, although one of those Republican seats is in Alaska, where they have yet to decide which Republican will finish there after they implemented ranked choice voting. So Kelly Schiavacca and incumbent Republican Lisa Murkowski are going to head into subsequent sort of rounds where they'll tabulate second and third and fourth choice rankings for that seat. But all eyes are frankly on right now Arizona and Nevada, as Georgia is going to a runoff on December 6th with Herschel Walker challenging incumbent Democrat Senator Raphael Warnock. That was, again, a razor-thin margin there. I think it was about 48,000 votes separated them. So they've got 4 weeks to get over that 50% threshold in Georgia. But right now, All eyes are frankly on Maricopa County in Arizona, where there's hundreds of thousands of ballots that have yet to be counted. I think I saw an update from the campaign not too long ago, Tony, and it's about 620,000 votes outstanding in Arizona right now. They're moving at a snail's pace in Maricopa County, which is the state's largest county, which is where Phoenix is. But both campaigns on the Republican side, it's Carrie Lake running for governor and then Blake Masters in Senate, are cautiously optimistic. It's apparently most of the outstanding vote is from Election Day, and so the thinking is that that's going to be Republican-leaning, and that will benefit both those campaigns. But at the moment, Carrie Lake trails by about, I think, 13,000 votes is what I saw last, and Blake Masters is a little bit more than 95,000. So he's got a much steeper climb to get past Mark Kelly, who's the Democrat incumbent there. And then when turning to Nevada, there's about 50,000 votes left. The majority of that's coming from Clark County, which is where Las Vegas is. And there's some outstanding rural vote there in Nevada as well. And the Laxalt team, Adam Laxalt, is a Republican challenger of Democrat incumbent Catherine Cortez Masto. Again, they're sounding cautiously optimistic that a lot of this remaining vote is going to tilt their way. So all eyes are on Maricopa County in Las Vegas, Nevada. It rings a lot similarly to how election night in 2020 panned out in those states.
All right, Matt Carpenter, beyond the tabulating the results, and could be days before we get the final numbers, what are some of the other takeaways from this election cycle?
You know, Tony, I was looking at some analysis from Cook Political Report today, and the final numbers on the electorate nationwide, if you look at total turnout, it was 52% of the electorate was made up of GOP voters and 46% Democrat voters. That's a R+6 electorate. That's similar to the 2010 wave. But what's different this time, Tony, is that in 2010, Republicans won the House by 63 seats. They swept the table. That was during Obama's first term. They came in storming and took control of the majority. What's happened since then is redistricting. And what a lot of states have done, save for a few in Florida and Tennessee come to mind, is they've protected incumbents. And so you have some very red districts that that frankly are not going to swing. And so I think we're looking at it's possible to have a wave election year like this, but the numbers to not really reflect that, because what we've seen is we've seen incumbents get entrenched in these R+20, R+30 districts in Texas and across the heartland of America.
Matt, we're giving a little inside lingo there. Explain very quickly to someone what an R+30, R+20 district is.
Yeah, that's going to be a district where whether we're looking at the registered voter data, or if you can kind of model out the electorate where you just draw from inferences based on voting history and consumer data, a partisan balance. So R+20 would be, you estimate that there's 20% more Republicans in that district than Democrats. So
it's favoring those Republicans. Right. Matt, we're going to be talking more probably tomorrow, but we're going to keep tracking this through the process, but we're out of time right now. Want to thank you for joining us. Always good to hear from you.
Thanks, Tony.
And folks, this really speaks to what we've been talking about, the divided nature of our country. And as he was saying, the redistricting, they've made these districts such that an incumbent, once they're in, it's so red or it's so blue, it's not going to change. And so you don't have the big sweeping waves come through. All right, stick with us. More election analysis on the other side of the break.
Given the all-out assault on the American male, it isn't surprising that the family structure is faltering. As a result, many men are frustrated and confused about what a real man is supposed to be. In response, Family Research Council's Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and Dr. Keenan Cureton's new book, Strong and Courageous, a sequel to Man to Man, offers a battle plan for men on how to take on their God-given responsibility in a culture swiftly turning away from God's design. The authors present the Old Testament book of Joshua and his leadership as the focus of their study, asking readers to consider the five principles of biblical manhood. Man is provider, instructor, battle buddy, defender, and chaplain. It is time for men to step into their role in the family and society and truly live out their God-given purpose. To purchase your copy of Strong and Courageous, A Call to Biblical Manhood, go to frc.org/strongandcourageous.
Thank you. Studies show that a majority of Americans believe they hold a biblical worldview, but in reality, most of our friends and neighbors, including those who attend church, don't think about the day's moral and cultural issues through a biblical lens. Christians need to be grounded in the truths of God's Word and be prepared to articulate them in a winsome manner, which is why Family Research Council's Center for Biblical Worldview was created. The center serves to help Christians understand the importance of Scripture in every aspect of life, why it must be authoritative, and how it can prepare believers to advance and defend faith in the workplace, in schools, in their communities, and in the public square. FRC's Center for Biblical Worldview has experts that provide research and resources to help believers address our culture's most pressing questions. Access these free resources at frc.org/worldview. See the Worldview Fellow's most recent work by signing up for the newsletter at frc.org/worldview email.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, and today I'm watching Washington from a distance. I'm actually in Southern California. We're at the His Channel studios as we prepare for tonight's event. We got a Friends of FRC dinner. We'll have probably 650 of our closest friends over to have dinner with former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. But anyway, we're here, and we're grateful for the hospitality of His Channel. All right, we were just discussing in the last segment, there is still much that we don't know, even after 2 days of the polls being closed and people, counting the votes. But there is also much that we do know, not only when it comes to the winners, but also when it comes to the voters and what they were saying. With me now to discuss this is Connor Simmelsberger. He's the Director of Federal Affairs for Life and Human Dignity at the Family Research Council. Connor, been a busy week. Welcome back to Washington Watch.
Good to be here.
All right, so many of the initial reactions have focused on how family and marriage dynamics continue to play a massive role in voter attitudes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so CNN had some very interesting exit polling that I think plays right into what we do here right at FRC. And that's how did married women and men, and how did women and men who are parents vote? Well, if you're married, you were much more likely to vote Republican. And the one demographic that was exceedingly in favor of Democrats, 68%, was unmarried women. Just stark contrast. Even unmarried men went for the GOP. So that was something that was a new trend. And you converse that to parents, and as much as Republicans tried to, or certain races played up parents' bills of rights and parental rights, it clearly didn't sink in with the voters, because even parents across the board, women who were parents, went to the Democrats even by a point. So cultural attitudes aren't just something we talk about here as platitudes, but it really matters on your worldview, how you engage in society, and as we found out this week, how you vote.
Well, we've known for years that people who buy houses, once they have home ownership, they become a little more fiscally conscious, especially when it comes to policy. But when they have children, we also know they become more socially conservative. Could that be why we see some of the policies of the left that, quite frankly, are encouraging people, number one, not to marry, at least not young, pushing marriage off, pushing childbearing off, hoping that those liberal ideas are locked in place for the duration?
I think that's spot on, really is. You think about it, pushing college for all delays marriage, delays home buying, just like you said, rather than college alternatives, maybe some people going right into the workforce. And boy, the abortion messaging has really sunk in, that they want young women to go to college, stay unmarried, put her career first, herself first, her travel expenses and all that stuff way before anything about starting a family, finding a spouse, having children, becoming a mother. Because as you said, once that happens, they lose that ingrainization that they have given to them all throughout their college years. So it's definitely been a focus of theirs. It looks like it played out for them a little bit this election.
Well, you know, and I hear a lot of times from parents saying, you know, how do I get my kids to move in the right direction when it comes to the way they think politically? Well, one, raise them in such a point where they'll be able to find the right spouse led by the Lord. They'll get married and they'll have children in that order and become productive members of society. And I mean, I've heard it over and over from young people. First time they have a child, they all of a sudden become very very concerned about the culture. All right, that's a conversation that we can have another day. I want to move into the election results at the state level. Now, you know, there was a lot of anticipation of this huge red wave. It didn't happen. We were talking a little bit earlier with Matt, made a lot of sense, that redistricting has really set Congress in such a place that there's not a lot of swing districts anymore. So these huge waves that we used to see just aren't something that's going to happen very often. But let's talk about what occurred at the state level. What do we know there?
Yeah, it was the same thing you saw at the federal level. You just take that down a notch. It was the same exact thing where things were good for Republicans. It was really good. State level in Florida, they won the governorship. They also got super majorities in the House and Senate. Same thing in Iowa. They reelected Kim Reynolds. They even flipped an attorney general's race in Iowa. A Democrat who had held that seat for 30 years went Republican, and they also gained super majorities. So where things went well at the state level for Republicans, it went really well. But you look at places like Michigan, Pennsylvania, where Democrats at the top of the ticket won governorships. They also flipped state houses and state senates. So just what you saw at the federal level, it's trickling down to the states too, where red states are getting redder, and where blue states have Democrats at the top, they're getting more Democratic.
Connor, do you think that the issue of abortion is going to accelerate that? As we this division of the country and these states, as you see the red states embracing life, putting into law, the Democratic states like Michigan actually putting, and California, putting abortion into their constitutions, that's going to be a further division of the country, is it not?
It really is, and it's sad to say, but that's just sort of a natural outgrowth of what Roe falling gave us now, right? California's more pro-abortion than they ever were. You see states like Florida and Iowa, they have good pro-life laws, but with supermajorities, they might even act further pro-life laws. So I think that's going to further silt our country, the big sort, as they've called it in the past, where people are going to just set in the segments where they're similar to everyone else, and continue to become more conservative, more liberal. And I think the abortion issue might even accelerate that even further. So we'll be in the thick of things pushing these pro-life laws, but it's something we're going to have to contend with in the future.
All right, Connor Simmelsberger, we're going to be talking more in the days ahead. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I encourage you to find a news source that reflects those values that you hold dear, and I recommend The Washington Stand, news with a biblical worldview. You can find all the details at washingtonstand.com. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I look forward to having you back here again next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.